to do? Solaro asked. Cowder closed his fist gently about the data spike. Deal with the matter directly, but politely, as a Huskarl should. Where is Eamon now? The pulpit, Solaro said.
It wasn't the chamber's official title, but it suited it well enough. The Cathedral Palace's central voxcaster station occupied the uppermost spires of the structure, where blue skies began to give way to the troposphere. Calder turned.
Come with me.
They made their way quickly to the central transit shaft, despite the crowded corridors. Since the enemy fleet had been sighted, the Cathedral Palace had seen a boom in its population. Not just troops, but scribes and officials. They packed the corridors of power, shouting to be seen and heard by the Cardinal Governor's staff. The Lord Deacons of the outlying cities wanted reinforcements. Representatives from the trade unions wanted the bulwarks pulled down, or more of them put up, in their competitors' territories. Lay priests and missionaries demanded the Cardinal Governor's ear, and the spokespeople for the noble families wanted to be evacuated. Despite the furore, the crowds parted before Calder. Scribes and noblemen alike scrambled from his path as he made his way down the main artery of the Cathedral Palace, Solaro trailing in his wake. Any not fast enough were shoved aside, if gently. Cyber cherubs followed at a discreet distance, artificial eyes recording everything.
I hate those things, Solaro murmured as they entered the transit platform.
Both Primaris wore their helms and spoke through the vox.
They should know better than to spy on us. It is almost heresy. They should know better than to do many things, and yet they do them all the same.
Solaro laughed.
Ha! True enough.
He looked at Calder.
They can't tell us apart, you know. The humans, I mean. We're human. Unaugmented humans. Are they colorblind?
Solaro studied him for a moment.
They can't tell the difference between a Primaris and a brother of the First Founding. I suppose, to a child, all giants look alike.
Solaro grunted.
My brothers can tell the difference, as can mine. But then, we are not children.
Calder looked at him. He wondered why Solaro was confiding in him. Perhaps it was simply that they were both Primaris. It was easier to talk to someone who understood, even if they wore a different heraldry.
They will accept you in time. It might be decades or centuries, but there will come a day when there is no difference between us. They think I am to replace them. You are, as every recruit is meant to replace a veteran.
Solaro was silent for a moment. Then,
have they accepted you?
Carter didn't reply. The transit platform juddered to a halt, and the doors opened. The hall beyond led directly to the pulpit. The corridor was mostly glass, save for the marble floor. The glass was void-hardened, and the frames that held the panes looked like gold, but were actually made from a ferroceramite blend. The pulpit extended off the side of the spire. It was a circular chamber, its outer wall studded with vox antenna and aerial relays. From within, a voice could be sent from one side of the planet to the other, as well as to the vessels in orbit. To either side and above, the skies were visible, as well as the orbital docking platforms that stretched upwards into the black. Tiny motes that were ships moved across the heavens, seeking safe berths against the encroaching storm. Calder watched them for a moment. The docklands of Almais were not so large as some he'd seen. Compared to those of Terra, they were barely there at all. But they were large enough to provide a tempting target for the enemy. The docklands had their own defences, several wings of attack craft and macro cannon batteries, enough to see off a casual raid. There was no telling if they would survive what was coming. Calder had ordered several squads of intercessors to lend their efforts to the defences. Hopefully, they would be enough. Eamon's guards were waiting for them at the end of the corridor. The Crusaders didn't move as Calder approached. He stopped as they raised their shields and locked them together. He detected the slight hum of a power field.
I need to speak with him.
They didn't move, nor did they speak. Tyre had mentioned something about a vow of silence, though he hadn't given any particulars. Carter suspected he knew the reason. Behind him, he heard the sound of a combat blade being drawn from its sheath. The Crusaders tensed. Calder waved Solaro back.
No,
he said. He studied the Crusaders, a man and a woman this time, by their body language. Both tall, their forms hidden beneath carapace armor and heavy robes, and their faces obscured behind featureless helms. He didn't want to kill them. He held up the data spike.
I know, he said simply. I know what he's hiding. I would speak with him. Let me pass.
The slightest of twitches was the only sign that they'd heard his words. His battle plate detected the faint murmur of an encrypted vox conversation, and he relaxed slightly. He knew that they would stand aside. A moment later, he was proven right. The shield parted. Carter glanced at Solaro.
Stay here.
He stepped past the guards into the pulpit. The chamber was circular with a high, vaulted roof. The walls were covered in vox recorders and relay equipment, and a dais occupied the center of the floor. The dais was surrounded by a palisade of vox casters, each manned by a robed acolyte. Several of these glanced fearfully at Calder as he entered, but Eamon waved them to stillness as he completed his latest address to the planetary population. And we will persevere, my friends, for that is our holy sovereign's will. Have no doubt of that. The time of tribulation is upon us, and we will not be found wanting. Go in glory, my children, and stay in peace. The Cardinal Governor stepped back as a triumphal ode started up. A choir of acolytes began to sing into a set of smaller voxcasters just below the dais. As their voices swelled, Eamon joined Calder.
A good speech.
I have some small skill in that regard, I admit. Eamon looked around. That it should have to come to this. I cannot help but feel this is the Emperor's judgment upon us. Upon me.
And have you done something to deserve his wrath?
Eamon smiled bitterly. A straightforward way of asking me what I'm hiding, Lieutenant. Then I expect no less from a son of Dawn. He paused. You had one of your warriors follow me, to the crypts at the heart of this city. He glanced at Calder, as if expecting a denial. Calder nodded.
I did.
He held up the data spike.
He recorded what he saw.
Eamon looked away. His shoulders slumped, not with resignation, but with something Calder thought might have been relief. And? He asked softly.
Answer my question.
Or what? Eamon asked. There was no defiance there, Calder judged. Simply curiosity. As if Eamon wished to know all the facts before making a decision. It was as if he had been expecting this moment for a long time.
Or I will confine you to your quarters and breach the crypt. I have no more time for these games. I need to know what's in there.
You won't kill me.
To execute you at this juncture would be to risk a civil revolt. If this city falls, it will not be due to my foolishness.
Calder looked down at him.
It would make things significantly easier if you were to simply tell me.
Eamon laughed softly. Yes, I expect so. He looked at the data spike. You were more cunning than I gave you credit for. Then maybe this is the God Emperor's will. He sighed. Answer me this. What are the chances of our survival at this moment, if all goes well? Calder answered immediately.
48%.
Eamon raised an eyebrow. That's a bit higher than I expected. He shook his head. And yet, not high enough to be a certainty. Very well. He looked at Calder. I will take you to the Anchorite. And may the God Emperor have mercy on my soul and yours. Almace, Primus Asteroid Facilities. It had taken a long time for the miners to decide on a spokesperson. Karros found it heartening. The lack of a leader implied that this was no organized rebellion, but instead a populist revolt. So far, he had seen little to indicate that there was anything more sinister than unhappy laborers to blame for the situation. That meant it could be dealt with quickly. The enforcers occupied the outer facilities, while the miners had been allowed to maintain control of the inner facility and transit paths. This arrangement sat well with neither side, but there was an equilibrium to it, so long as the Raven Guard occupied the middle ground. The factions had decided to meet in the no-man's land between the outer and inner facility, a labyrinth of gantries and causeways that stretched in all directions. Karros stood on a platform at the heart of the web of steel, the commander of the enforcer detachment beside him.
"They're here,"
Regulator Galba said. Galba was a heavy-set man, ill-shaped for the tight confines of the mining facility. He gestured towards an approaching grav-shunt with his shock maul.
"I am aware. I detected them some time ago,"
Karros said.
"We should take them into custody as soon as they step onto this platform."
Karros looked down at the man.
"We will not."
Galba shifted nervously.
"I said that we should, not that we would."
Karros studied the man for a moment longer. He didn't particularly care for Galba. The Regulator was a brute and a simpleton, the perfect commander for a punishment garrison. But this was no longer a punishment garrison. It was the front line. He turned away as the shunt came to a stop. Spiros whistled softly. Karros glanced up. Figures in hazard suits and ash cloaks crowded the highest gantries, just out of Orspec's range. Galba saw them a moment later. He cursed and groped for his sidearm.
"Ambush! I knew it! Can't trust these stinking—"
Karros silenced him with a gesture.
"If it were an ambush, they would have already started shooting. Likely they are here to prevent you from doing as you just suggested. Now be silent."
He stepped forward to meet the miner's representative. Startled, she stumbled and fell back. He looked down at her, scanning her features and comparing them to the pic captures of facility laborers.
"Reyes," he said. "Sedalia Reyes, Warloader Primus class."
She was dark for a Voidborn and compact. She wore an Warloader's body glove and had a gear belt cinched about her waist. A number of tools hung from it, including a plasma cutter. The thin, blade-like device was meant for cutting through solid rock or metal. She also had an autogun slung across her shoulder. She stared up at him, eyes wide. Karros reached out his hand.
"I am Lieutenant Karros of the Raven Guard."
Reyes averted her eyes as Karros drew her to her feet.
You're bigger than I thought," she mumbled, as she adjusted the autogun. I've never seen one of you before."
"I am considered small for my rank,"
Karros said. She gawped at him.
"What?"
"Never mind."
He paused.
"You are brave to meet us in the open."
"Someone had to, my lord," she added quickly.
She straightened and said,
"What did you want to say to us?"
Karros let the red gaze of his helm play across the catwalks and gantries surrounding him before answering. There were hundreds of them now, some young, some old. He knew that Spiros and the others could kill them all, if he gave the order, but to do so would be a waste and required too much time.
"The system is under attack. The enemies of man ride fast upon the gates of Almes. You stand between your world and the ships of the foe."
"Not my world,"
Reyes spat, suddenly defiant.
"This here is my world. Just this. I'm void-born and bred."
"You are an Imperial citizen, rock-cur,"
Galba snarled, raising his shock maul.
"And you will do a citizen's duty."
"Quiet,"
Karros rumbled. Galba blanched and stepped back. Karros looked at Reyes.
"They will take these facilities as well. Almes alone will not satisfy them."
"There's thousands of leagues of tunnels," she said, half-heartedly.
"And how long can you hold out when you lose access to hydroponics and the hydrogen recyclers? or when they begin exposing parts of the facility to the vacuum. We can survive that. You cannot.
Kairos released her.
If you wish to have any hope of survival, you will listen to me.
What about our grievances?
Kairos paused. She was brave, if nothing else.
And what grievances would these be?
They were going to abandon us,
Reyes said. She glared at Galba as she spoke.
Seal the facility, destroy the generators, and leave us to suffocate. That's why we took over.
Protocol demands,
Galba began, his face flushed.
Protocol is suspended,
Kairos said.
You are both hereby seconded to my command, by order of the Cardinal Governor.
He boosted his vox.
You are all hereby placed under my authority. You are no longer miners or revolutionaries. You are soldiers. If you cannot fight, some other task will be found for you. But from this moment on, you answer to me. I will now give you a moment to voice any objections you might have.
Galba coughed.
My lord, this is highly questionable. These rock cures can't...
Kairos gestured. Spyros caught Galba by the skull and twisted. The regulator gave a little squawk as his bones snapped. His boot heels thudded against the floor as Spyros let him slump. Chain and the others raised their bolt guns, covering the remaining enforcers. Kairos nodded.
Objections noted.
He looked down at Reyes.
What about you?
No, my lord,
she whispered, staring at Galba's body.
Good.
He turned to the enforcers.
Which of you is second in command?
One of them stepped forward, somewhat hesitantly.
Enforcer Desh, my lord,
he said, with a shaky salute. Kairos reached down and tore the sigil of rank from Galba's sleeve. He extended the patch to Desh.
You are now regulator, Desh. Do a better job than your predecessor, and you might even survive.
He turned, letting his red gaze play across the crowded gantries.
That goes for all of you. Obey my orders, and you may well live to continue your labors. Disobey and die, either at the hands of the enemy or mine. Those are your only choices.
He drew his bolt pistol and hefted it meaningfully.
I suggest you decide quickly.
Elmes. Primaris Grade Cardinal World. The bulkhead hissed open, releasing a gust of chill, stale air. Ancient recyclers kicked on, stirring the atmosphere. Calder followed Eamon into the dimly lit chamber, his auto-senses immediately registering a towering presence to his left. He turned, hand falling automatically to his sidearm.
You wanted to see what I have been hiding, Eamon said. Here he is, Lieutenant Calder. Meet the Anchorite.
Welcome.
The voice was at once awful and comforting. Calder paused, hand on his weapon, as the Anchorite, huge and monstrous, stepped into the light. The ancient Contemptor Dreadnought was a towering presence, bipedal and hulking, with only the basest resemblance to a human shape. A giant of ceramite and iron. A war machine from a forgotten age, its hull marked with sigils of purity and prayer scrolls. Its arms ended in two great, crushing claws that flexed and whined idly. Calder stared. Contemptor dreadnoughts were rare these days. The machine bore no heraldry, and no colours. It was grey and bare of all ornamentation. The ancient war machine observed him with glowing optical senses, but made no move towards him.
You are a new thing under the sun.
He rumbled.
Have all of the sons of Dawn grown so in stature over the centuries of my isolation? No, we are a new breed, or perhaps an old one, depending.
Calder pulled his hand away from his bolt pistol.
Who are you? Young Aemon told you. I am the Anchorite. Your name? I have no name. The man I was is dead. I am all that stands here, a humble bearer of words. Look, see.
Lumens flickered to life, revealing the walls and the innumerable lines of script carved into them. Calder looked from the walls to the dreadnought.
Bearer of words, he said flatly.
A sudden anger pulsed in him. He thought he knew now why Aemon had been so reluctant to reveal this particular secret.
A peculiar phrase,
he looked at Aemon.
Explain now. Leave him, son of Dawn. This is not Aemon's doing, not the doing of his ancestors. They are here and have been my captors, my hosts, for longer than you have been as you are, and not by their choice, I assure you. Who are you to assure me of anything? A nameless traitor, hidden in the heart of this city. By rights, I should execute you both.
He tried to hold Aemon's gaze, but the Cardinal Governor shook his head and looked away.
Do you know what an anchorite is, boy?
Something in the dreadnought's tone brought Calder up short.
I am not familiar with the term, no,
he said after a moment. A quick tactical analysis told him that if the anchorite decided to attack, there was little he could do to harm the war machine. Listening was the best of bad options.
A man of faith who confines himself so as to become closer to his god. That is what an anchorite is, and that is who I am. And who is your god?
Calder asked.
Who do you think, boy?
The anchorite leaned close.
There is only one god in this universe, and he sits upon a throne of gold.
Calder stared up at the dreadnought, momentarily nonplussed.
What? The god emperor, boy. It's in the title.
The anchorite made a sound that might have been a sigh.
Theology was never your legion's strong suit. Good at building, but not thinking, as Lorga used to say.
Another soft, hissing sigh.
Lorga. Salvation and damnation in one. Poor, foolish Lorga. He couldn't see that it was a test of our devotion, of our faith. Then, none of us did. Except you,
Calder asked.
Not even me, not at first. I was as angry as any of them. I thought, how dare he deny us? His truest sons, how dare he cast our works into the dust? But things changed at Kalth.
The anchorite raised his talons and studied them.
I saw what we were doing, down there in the dark, and thought it only just, an eye for an eye. The scions of Ultramar had torn down our temples and shattered our fanes, had put the faithful to the sword. Was it not just to seek recompense? To meet like with like?
The dreadnought turned, ancient servos whirring.
Then an epiphany, a crash of understanding amid the tumult of war. I saw the futility of it all. Ouroboros, the serpent that devours its own tail. They broke us, and we sought to break them. But we have become stronger for the breaking, and so too might they. And then what? More wars, more vengeance, meted out across the tapestry of the galaxy?
There was a sound. Calder wondered if the ancient warrior was laughing. Or weeping. The anchorite stretched out a claw and touched the words etched into the metal of his cell. There was something almost wistful in the gesture.
I saw then that the cycle could end only one way. So I stopped. I set aside my blade and bent my knee. I waited for my cousins, for Gilliman's sons, to kill me there in the dark. And they might have, but fate had other plans in store.
They spared you,
Calder said in disbelief. None of this made any sense. It was madness. And yet, the evidence was before him.
In a manner of speaking.
The anchorite made a sound that Calder was now certain was laughter.
I was put in chains and interred in an oubliette, left to rot for the rest of that war. When my brothers broke themselves on the walls of terror, I sat in the dark and prayed for their souls. Things answered me, seeking to sway me from my penance. But I am no stranger to such spirits. The deserts of Colchis were thick with them, like fleas on a cur's back. I banished them from me and continued my prayers.
A sudden thought occurred to Calder.
This time we speak of, you were not interred in a dreadnought then?
No. That came later.
Calder glanced at Aemon. The Cardinal Governor cleared his throat.
The anchorite attempted to take his own life, not the first time, but the most successful, necessitating the procurement of an amniotic sarcophagus.
Calder had trouble fathoming such a thing. He turned to look at the hulking dreadnought. The ancient warrior seemed to slump, as if in shame.
Why? I am weak,
the dreadnought turned.
We were all weak. Weak of soul, weak of body and will. We allowed all that we had built to fall to ruin, for the lies of a few. Absolution lies only in death,
Calder recited.
Indeed, cousin. But my absolution is denied me. Century upon century I persist. I share my wisdom with those of the true faith. The faith my brothers, my gene father, turn from.
Calder paused, wondering if he'd heard correctly.
You share your wisdom?
I was quite the scribe in my youth. I wrote down the pronouncements of the holy and committed every prayer to memory. I read one of the first copies of the Lectitio Divinitatis, that most sacred of texts. See, here, the great passages inscribed upon these walls. Is it not beautiful?
Calder felt a chill race through him. Though he could not say why. He turned, truly seeing the markings for the first time. He looked at Aemon, seeking some answer to a question he could not voice.
The anchorite has been one of the voices guiding the ecclesiarchy from the beginning, the Cardinal Governor said softly. So much of what we are is thanks to him, though we have diverged somewhat in recent centuries.
Aemon's smile was a brittle thing. Calder wondered what it must have been like for a mortal to learn that the origins of his faith lie in the ramblings of a mad legionary, confined to a war machine.
All rivers must find their own way,
the anchorite said.
Such is the nature of faith.
How?
Calder asked.
How? How did any of this happen?
Mercy,
the anchorite said.
The future is always born in mercy. It's giving, or the lack of it. Gilliman spared me. I do not know why. Maybe he saw what I saw, that the way forward could not be built on a foundation of treachery and vengeance. Or maybe...
He trailed off, servos grinding, as he turned away from Calder.
I do not know. I know only that I persist, and in persisting am driven to speak, to share what I learned that day.
The anchorite fell silent. Calder felt a peculiar flash of pity for the ancient warrior.
He did not speak of you, he said.
What?
The anchorite's head turned, gears protesting.
Gilliman, he did not speak of you when I was assigned this task. Why?
How should I know? Perhaps he has forgotten me.
A dull rumble of mechanical laughter followed.
That would be fitting, I think. A fair reward for one such as I.
He has not forgotten you, Eamon said softly.
Calder looked at him. Eamon cleared his throat.
After our initial request for aid was ignored, I used a certain code sequence devised by the Primarch when the Anchorite was first given into my ancestors' keeping.
Eamon traced his fingers across one of the litanies, scratched into the wall.
He knew, even then, that the arch-enemy would come for their prodigal brother. Perhaps not for millennia, but eventually.
He looked at Calder, his eyes wet with unshed tears.
And now, they have.
He swallowed.
I knew the moment we were cut off, the moment contact with the other systems was lost, that the day had come around at last. So, I sent a message, hoping that it would find him. Find you.
Eamon's voice was thick with emotion. There was fear there, and grief, but also hope. Calder understood. He looked at the anchorite.
We lack the manpower and resources to resist a conventional siege for long. It will be anything but a conventional siege, I suspect.
The anchorite shifted his weight, and the cell shook.
My brothers and I espoused a different philosophy of war to most. We believed the quickest blow was best. Dig for the vitals immediately.
He gestured with a claw for emphasis.
If they are here for me, they will attack the Cathedral Palace. That will be their focus, to the exclusion of all else. So I have surmised.
Calder turned to Eamon.
We will need to isolate the Cathedral Palace. I had hoped to use it as a supply route between fronts, but if their end goal is to require your...
Guest, Eamon interjected.
Prisoner,
Calder went on.
Then we must prevent that at all costs. We will need to split the city, destroy transit routes, seal access paths and barricade every gate and tunnel. Parts of the city must be sacrificed to save the whole.
His mind was already conducting the necessary calculations. His earlier strategies were nothing but ash now. New ones would be required. In a way, it was a relief. It was a simpler thing to defend one area than an entire city. Necessary resources could be freed up and put to better use elsewhere, and new defensive measures implemented. But there was no time to complete them all before the enemy arrived. Some would have to be done under fire. He spared only a brief thought for those he'd impressed into service to defend Lowtown. Their sacrifice was more necessary now than ever. The blood they would shed would buy him the time he needed to make the Cathedral Palace inviolate. His own blood, too, come to that, and that of his warriors, and Karos and Sabodan, and Eamon as well. All their lives were mortar for his walls. In the end, that was a price he was more than willing to pay for victory. Chapter 17 83-0030 Odoacer System, Corward Edge. The Matnam slumped in his command throne, watching the end of his quest approach. Almace was a vibrant orb, even at a distance. It was ringed by a wide halo of stellar debris, asteroids and dust turning with infinitesimal slowness, like a great wheel. Beyond it, an array of orbital defences and dockyards crowned the world.
"Beautiful, is it not?"
he said to Apis. The other word-bearer stood nearby, hands clasped behind his back, the very image of the soldier at rest.
"It looks like a target to me, but a beautiful one."
Amatlim studied the hololithic data feeds from the long-range augers. The orbital defences were archaic but well-maintained, unlike those they'd encountered above Pergamon. The fleet would take heavy losses just getting into position, and there were few of them left as it was. But it would be worth it in the end. And besides, the gods only promised glory, not that you would live to claim it. He'd given orders for the rest of the fleet to take up an approach formation to navigate the debris field. The sooner they were through, the better. The Glory Eternal anchored the center, with the remaining cruisers to either side. Frigates and pirate vessels ranged ahead and on the flanks. Assault craft arrowed in front, hunting the foe. Apis coughed discreetly, alerting him to the presence of a newcomer. Amatnim didn't turn.
"What do you want, Lacomhue?"
"Kelim has not reported in,"
Lacomhue said from behind his throne.
"Don't you have an assault to be preparing for, brother?"
"Others can oversee the chattel. I wish to speak to you before the end."
Amatnim glanced up at the Dark Apostle. Lacomhue wasn't looking at him, but at the viewscreen. Yattle stood behind him, alongside Lacomhue's remaining bladeslave. The creature glared at Amatnim and shifted its weight, as if in anticipation of an attack. Yattle's gaze was unreadable, though he had his helm clasped under his arm. Amatnim smiled and turned away.
"Speak then, O worthy emissary of the gods. Unburden your soul, I beg you."
Lacomhue grunted.
"Kelim has not reported in."
"So you said."
"Are you not concerned?"
"Not particularly. We are not pursued. If he failed, then at least he might have taken them with him. And if he succeeded, he will join us soon enough."
Amatnim smiled.
"And are you concerned, then? Or was this merely a pretext to chastise me?"
Lacomhue did not turn his gaze from the viewscreen. Amatnim realized that he was studying the debris field.
"Our forces are depleted. Can we truly take this world?"
"Perhaps. I am not planning on it, however."
Amatnim gestured to the distant planet.
"No, I want only one thing from this world, and once I have it, we can burn Almace to glass for all I care. Or leave it to the children of the gods, if that is your preference."
Lacomhue laughed softly.
"Not mine, but the gods might well appreciate it."
He looked at Amatnim.
"Once this is done, there will be a settling of accounts between us, brother. I will have recompense for what I have endured."
"And what have you endured, brother, that was not of your own making?"
Lacomhue frowned.
"Am I to blame, then, for your attempts at provocation?"
Amatnim made a show of considering this, then shook his head sadly.
"The Urizen had a saying about provocation, did he not? Remind me of it."
Lacomhue's frown deepened.
"Provocation is the soil in which knowledge flourishes."
"And there we are. Wisdom at last."
Amatnim pushed himself to his feet. Lacomhue's bladeslave grunted and grasped the hilt of its weapon more tightly.
"This game between us is one of provocation. We push against one another, testing and challenging each other. The truth is a garden of forking paths. We have each chosen a path and are determined to lead the other down it.
Now I know that my path is the correct one, but so too do you. But the garden is the same, whatever the chosen path. Lacombe Hugh laughed.
Fine. You wish to speak of truth. Do you truly believe that what you seek will undo Erebus? And if so, that the result will mean a stronger legion?
He grinned mirthlessly.
Or will it be our end? That is my fear, brother, that your path leads to the doom of us all, and you are too blind to see it.
Amatnim frowned. I think you underestimate us.
And I think Corferin has fed you a steady diet of half-truths and spite. Throughout this whole affair, you have insisted on your path, on your truth, to the exclusion of all others. You play the philosopher, but you are nothing of the sort. You want me to walk your path, but you will not even consider mine.
And why should I? I know Erebus well enough to know that he is not worthy to be my master, nor is he worthy of being yours. Lacombe Hugh shook his head.
That is not for such as you or I to say. The gods choose us. We do not choose them.
There, at least, we agree. Amatnim crossed his arms. You are right. When this is done, all accounts will be settled. Not just between us, but for the Legion as a whole. All secrets will be brought to light, all truths revealed. An apocalypse, in the ancient sense of the word. Then, you will know the truth as I know it.
Or you will know my truth,
Lacombe Hugh said pugnaciously. We shall see. For now, brother, you have your orders. See to them. Lacombe Hugh's lip curled in a sneer.
Gloria aeterna, brother.
Gloria aeterna, Lacombe Hugh. Lacombe Hugh gestured to his blade slave and turned to depart. Amatnim let him get halfway to the steps and then said,
Yattle, stay.
Yattle hesitated, but Lacombe Hugh nodded and the warrior relaxed. As the Dark Apostle departed, Yattle turned to meet Amatnim's gaze. You owe me a debt, Amatnim said. You recall this?
Yes.
Yattle bowed his head.
What would you have of me, my lord?
The way he asked the questions said he already knew. Amatnim had little sympathy for him. Yattle was ambitious and foolish in equal measure. Such men soon fell afoul of the wicked and the wise alike.
I think you know.
Yattle paused.
Lacombe Hugh is loyal, my lord.
I suggest learning how to dissemble, if you wish to have a future as a provocateur, brother.
He is not loyal. He is a blade at my back, and I grow tired of waiting for him to strike, so I will do it first. Kill him. Kill him and be exalted in my sight. Will you do this?
Amatnim knew what Yattle's answer would be, even before he'd asked the question. Yattle would make the attempt, because he knew Amatnim would compensate him fairly, and because he feared the consequences if he said no.
I live but to serve the chosen of the gods, my lord,
Yattle said, head bowed. Amatnim laughed.
A very careful choice of words. The Urizen would approve.
He gestured dismissively.
Go. I leave the details to you. You were blunt with him, Apis said. Was that wise? He might just tell Lacombe Hugh.
I have no doubt he will. And even if he doesn't, Lacombe Hugh will suspect him regardless. He might even attempt to kill him. Poor Yattle will be forced to defend himself. Apis frowned.
You don't care if he succeeds, do you?
No. I simply want Lacombe Hugh preoccupied until we have succeeded in our quest.
Why not simply kill him?
Amatnim sat down in his throne. He considered his words before replying.
Because I am not yet sure which of us is on the right path through the garden.
He looked at Almace.
But once we have our prize in hand, I will be. And then I will know which of us is right and which of us is wrong. I will know which of us serves the right master. I will know which of us is the Urizen's truest servant.
He leaned back, eyes closed.
I will know which of us the gods have truly blessed.
The deployment bay was in tumult as Apis descended the gantry stairs. It was a pleasant sort of confusion, however. He'd always found it comforting, the sound of ammunition hoppers being loaded, of assault vehicles being readied, the crash of steel and the cursing of warriors. No, soldiers. Apis did not think of himself as a warrior. He was a soldier through and through. Discipline was his dogma, and he held it with all the fervour he could muster. Warriors looked at battle as a lover. Apis knew that it was a task to be accomplished. He watched as something that had once been a predator battle tank scuttled across the deck on jointed legs of meat and iron. Past it, he spied Lacamhue and his closest followers making for a gunship. Idly, his hand settled on his sidearm. An easy shot, even from here. One pull of the trigger, and the threat was ended. But he restrained himself. Not out of fear or worry, but respect. Imatnim wanted Lacamhue alive. It was a mistake, but it was Imatnim's to make. Apis just hoped he wouldn't be among those who paid for it. He knew that both Imatnim and the Dark Apostle thought him a fool. They thought him a pawn and unambitious. Apis was both, and content to be so. But that did not make him an idiot. Things were coming to a head between them. Lacamhue would be forced to retaliate, even if Yattle failed, or refused Imatnim's command. Imatnim was counting on it. But Apis intended to see that any such retaliation was unsuccessful. Indeed, he intended to make sure that Lacamhue never even got the chance to retaliate. Two, he wanted to check on his own followers, to make sure that they were ready for the battle to come. He continued his descent, noting the immense queues of mortal warriors, waiting to file into the bellies of dropships and troop landers. Behind them waited red-daubed battle tanks and assault vehicles. Some of those in the queues were cultists. Others had been soldiers of the Astra Militarum, or Planetary Defense Forces. All now served the primordial truth. Apis watched as a Leman Russ, studded with sensors and skulls, trundled up a loading ramp, its crew singing an off-key hymn.
A sight to stir the eye, Cor, is it not, Captain?
Apis turned as a familiar voice cut through the noise. He recognized two of his men, Sapper and Gernt, sitting on overturned ammunition drums nearby. Sapper, as always, was sharpening a combat blade, one of a half a dozen he kept on him at all times. Most were standard issue. Others were of Xenos manufacture, including one he'd taken off a Rakgol clutch master, and at least one that was demon-tainted. Sapper never drew that one. Instead, he left it to murmur incessantly in its wolf-skin sheath. Gernt was having his head shaved by one of his slaves. Oil, made from the fruit of the strange trees that now grew in the ship's hydroponics bay, was smeared over his scalp and cheeks, before a straight razor marked with ugly sigils was scraped across his flesh. Another slave carefully reassembled his bolt gun, murmuring prayers over each shell.
"Is that you, Captain?"
Gernt called out.
"I can feel your disapproving glare from here."
"You shouldn't let a slave assemble your weapon," Apis said as he joined them.
"Or get close to your neck with a knife." "Probably not,"
Gernt said as he turned his head, and the slave carefully applied the ritual razor across his cheek and jaw, scraping away offending hairs.
"Still, you really should let him shave you, brother. He's a wonder with a razor, this one. If he had any spine, he'd make a fine killer."
He chucked the slave under the chin affectionately.
"Oh, wouldn't you, meat?"
"As my lord wills," the slave murmured haltingly. His body was marked with brands of ownership and servitude.
"Very obliging," Sapa said.
Apis frowned. Slaves never lasted long when they caught Sapa's eye. He liked to break and bend them into more aesthetically pleasing shapes for the entertainment of those who shared his enthusiasms. Whole religions had sprung up below decks, based around avoiding Sapa's notice. But he kept his foolishness off the battlefield, and that was all that mattered. Like Gernt, he was a satisfactory line soldier, capable of following orders or acting on his own initiative, depending on the circumstances. There were precious few soldiers left in the Legion these days.
"He's got that look, brother,"
Gernt said. Sapa nodded.
"Well, it has been several days since he last complained about the state of the Legion."
"True. One must vent choler, lest it choke one.
Remember Ulam? He choked on his choler.
I thought he choked on blood."
"Well, he was very angry about the blood."
"Are you two finished?"
Apis asked.
"For the moment."
Gernt borrowed Sabah's knife and examined his reflection in the blade.
"Satisfactory. You may go, meat."
The slave bobbed his head and hurried away. Gernt looked up at Apis.
"Come to give us our marching orders, brother?"
Apis turned and looked out across the bay, watching as several troop transports rumbled towards the assault landers. Voxcasters mounted on the hulls blared doleful droning hymns to the Lord of all things.
"We'll be accompanying a matnim to the planet's surface."
Sapa chuckled.
You did well catching his eye, brother. We will go far with him. That isn't why I did it, brother."
"Of course not,"
Sapa said. Gernt laughed. Apis looked at them.
"Our legion is dying, brothers."
"I told you,"
Gert muttered. Sapper sighed.
"Be silent. I am being serious. The Urizen has abandoned us. Corferon, Erebus, the rest of the Dark Council. They war with one another while the galaxy burns around them. The Black Legion conquers new territories. The Death Guard march in the shadow of Mortarion's wings. Even the God's damned Emperor's children seem more united now than they have ever been. And where are we? Where are the Forerunners? Those of us who saw the truth and embraced it earliest? I can't speak for Sapa, but I'm right here,"
Gern said.
"I'm slightly to the left of him," Sapa added.
Apis shook his head.
"This is not the time for jokes, brothers. The universe is boiling in its own bile. Now is the perfect time."
Gernt rose to his feet and idly cuffed the slave, assembling his bolt gun.
"You're doing it wrong. Go away."
The slave scrambled away, whimpering. Gernt began to disassemble the weapon.
"Why did you come down here, Apis? Are you worried?" "You should be. Sapa and I are both worried, aren't we, brother?"
"I am distinctly uneasy with the current situation,"
Sapa said. He drew a knife and tossed it into the deck, puncturing the metal with ease.
"But that's natural, isn't it?"
Gern looked around.
"The gods keep us worried, so we keep to the path they have laid out for us. It's the way of the galaxy."
"And what path is that?"
Apis said.
"Where will our path take us?" "Ah, there it is. He thinks we've chosen the wrong side, brother,"
Gernt said.
"Is that it? Should we have thrown our lot in with Lacamhue then?"
"No,"
Apis shook his head.
"But Amatnim thinks he will throw in his lot with us."
Sapa laughed.
"That won't happen this century."
"No,"
Apis agreed.
"That is why I'm down here. Come with me."
They looked at one another, but followed him without question as he made his way towards the waiting gunships. Some of the craft were chained to the deck, like predatory beasts. They twitched and cycled their empty weapons at anyone who drew close. Others were relatively new, their machine spirits as yet uncorrupted by exposure to the warp. Gernt leaned close.
"What are we doing, Captain?"
Apis didn't reply. He pointed towards a bulky craft, studded with religious paraphernalia, its hull covered with barnacle-like sensors.
"There. The Dark Apostle's gunship. You know the pilot?" "Yes. Decimo of the Savage Tabernacle. Good pilot. Bad at everything else."
Apis nodded.
"Do you see him?"
Gernt turned, scanning the crowd of crew and warriors that moved to and fro among the launch plinths.
"There,"
he said, indicating a small group of warriors standing nearby. They broke out in raucous laughter as one of them gesticulated, obviously embellishing some tale of glories past.
"He's the one flapping his mouth."
Apis glanced at Sapa.
"Fetch him."
Sapa grinned and drew one of his blades.
"In how many pieces?"
"One, preferably. I just want to talk to him."
Sapa frowned, but loped towards the gathering. Gernt leaned close.
"I ask again, Captain, what are we doing?"
Apis smiled.
"Making sure we're on the right path."
Almace, Primus Asteroid Facilities. Lacamue sat back in his restraint throne, his crozius across his knees. Around him, the gunship's passenger compartment rattled and shook. Thick bands of incense wafted through stultifying air, and mutant serfs scuttled along the nave, checking the weapons and war gear of the word-bearers, seated to either side of the walkway. The gunship was one of two accompanying a trio of assault landers to the mining facilities, a small army, but an army nonetheless. Every warm body that could be spared had been roused and made ready to take the facilities. Once the main facility was under control, they'd spread to the others. Each would fall in turn, until the entire belt was under Amatnem's control. Or, rather, under Lacamhue's control. He smiled. A grunt caught his attention. His blade slave crouched nearby, glaring at nothing in particular. The creature had been agitated since its twin had died. He wondered if that was due more to the nature of the rituals used in its creation, or some lingering remnant of the man it had been. Either way, it was growing annoying. It refused to sit still, and instead paced blindly or snarled at anyone who got too close, especially Yattle. Poor, ambitious Yattle. Lacamhue could read his aide's uncertainty. Yattle had wisely said nothing, but he was smart enough to know that Lacamhue was already aware of his treachery. As was Amatnim. His hands closed about the haft of his crozius, and he frowned. He glanced around the passenger compartment of the gunship. Fewer warriors than he would have liked. Amatnim had only given him a handful of true warriors to oversee the efforts of several hundred chattels, but it would be enough. All of them were loyal to him, of course. He'd made certain of it. The only question was Yattle. And even that wasn't so much a question of if, as when and how. Lacamhue closed his eyes and tried to center himself. Meditation was another tool in the arsenal of the faithful. It helped order the mind and calm the spirit. Two things necessary for a man to successfully commune with the primordial truth. He listened as Neverborn whispered to him, just beyond the veil of consciousness. They showed him things, sometimes. Memories of a future that would never be, or predictions of a past that had never been. Lies mixed with truth, and truth leavened by lies. They scratched at the walls of his psyche, demanding entrance, pleading for aid, enticing and inviting. Little demons, most of them. Even the strongest were but minor sparks compared to the great conflagrations he'd seen summoned by Erebus. But they could be useful nonetheless. They flocked to the black radiance of his soul, knowing that he would open the way for them, eventually. He could feel the soul heat of his brothers as the Neverborn gathered about them as well. Word-bearers collected minor demons the way a cur collected fleas. Most never even noticed the insubstantial parasites clinging to them. Ematnim had none. Lacamue had often wondered why that was, why demons avoided him, seemed to fear him, even. He concluded that the gods had marked the warlord somehow, either for greatness or damnation. He wasn't sure which yet, but he knew which he preferred. He opened his eyes and found his blade slave watching him. He extended his hand, and the creature snuffled at it.
"He will pay for murdering your twin. Never fear," he murmured, "for that blasphemy and all the rest."
The bulkhead at the other end of the compartment hissed open, admitting Yattle.
"They're ignoring our requests to land," he said, as he made his way down the nave of the compartment. "I do believe that Ematnim's pet pirate overstated the welcome we would receive."
Lacamhue snorted.
"If you had to defend this world and such unrest occurred, what would be your first instinct, brother?"
"I would quash it with prejudice."
"Exactly. There are imperial fists on this world, and white scars. Neither are known for their soft feelings towards baseline meat."
Ematnim had known. Lacamhue could feel it in his water. He'd known, and sent Lacamhue to die, or to expend his strength on a useless endeavour. But Lacamhue was determined to confound those expectations. He would take the facilities and hold them. He would make use of them, perhaps even employ them somehow against Ematnim. He imagined asteroids, jostled loose from the belt, hurtling into Almace's atmosphere, and smiled. Wouldn't that be a surprise for the conquering warlord?
"Like as not, that facility is now an enemy fortress," he continued. "One we must take."
Landing klaxons whined, and Lacamhue pulled on his helm. The gunship began its descent.
"So, let us take it."
Chapter 18. 85-40-00. Almace, Primaris Grade, Cardinal World. Calder pushed the great doors to the chambers of the astropathic choir open, ignoring the agitated clicks of the entry servitors, whose routine he'd upset. He had no more patience for such ceremonies. His mind was akin to a box, filled to overflowing, its former order given over to confusion. Had Gilliman known, when he'd sent them here, that they would discover the anchorite? Had he hoped that secret would remain hidden? Or perhaps the opposite? The Primarch's fraught relationship with the Ecclesiarchy was well known. Perhaps this was part of some greater gambit on the Lord Commander's part. Calder didn't know, and not knowing frustrated him. He was trained to see the patterns in such things, and yet this pattern defied logic. The existence of the anchorite was a secret that might well destroy the Ecclesiarchy, or, at the very least, shatter it into opposing camps, even more so than it already was. Maybe that was Gilliman's aim. He shook his head, banishing the thought even as it occurred to him. Whatever Gilliman's reasons, Calder was here now and knew the truth. His strategies would have to be adapted to compensate. If the anchorite was the enemy's goal, it gave him a point to defend, and he would do so regardless of the cost. The choir guard met him in the vestibule. There were 10 of them, clad in heavy carapace armour, ornately decorated with the images of saints and cherubs, and overflowing with purity scrolls. Each wore a thick cloak of imperial purple, and a helm wrought in the shape of an angel's face. They levelled wicked-looking power glaives as he came to a halt.
"Lower your weapons," a voice called out from deeper in the chamber. "The lieutenant is expected."
The guards stepped aside for Calder. He passed them without a backward glance. The chief astropath was waiting for him. She wore thick red robes over her frail form, and a crimson cloth over her ravaged eyes. If she had a name, she had not shared it, and he had not had the inclination to ask.
"A belated welcome, my lord. You have not visited us in some time."
"My apologies," Calder said. "Other matters have demanded my attentions. Has there been any message from the Lord Commander?"
She shook her head.
"It is quiet, my lord, save for an unpleasant scratching at the walls of our souls."
Her smile slipped.
"That particular sound is getting louder. Before long, we will not be able to risk lowering our defences."
"Nor would I ask you to do so, unless the need were great," Calder said.
If the astropathic choir was compromised, they would be cut off entirely. He looked around the chamber, taking in her assistants and servants. The room felt crowded, despite its size. The walls were decorated with murals drawn from the life of the God Emperor and his sons. Gold-skinned cherubs crouched in the rafters, murmuring softly to one another. Sanctified combat servitors crouched in their sentry alcoves, watching for any signs of warp taint in the members of the choir. The chief astropath nodded.
"You wish to send a final message? I cannot promise that it will reach its destination, but we will try."
"Yes, a request for reinforcements. I fear we may need them." He paused. "Has there been any word from Sabodan Khan or the System Defence Fleet?"
"None, my lord. I hear echoes occasionally of voices, of messages yet to be sent, but nothing else."
She leaned against her staff.
"If they still live, they are being very quiet."
Calder nodded.
"If that is the case, perhaps it is for the best."
If Sabodan still lived, he would likely be making for Almes. Neither way, he could not afford to factor the silent horseman into his strategy. An alert chimed in his ear. The vox crackled with a dozen voices. Somewhere far below, an alarm klaxon began to wail. One of the guards stepped into the chamber.
"My lady, my lord, the enemy has been sighted just past the asteroid belt. We must seal these chambers in preparation for the siege." "I will leave you to it, then."
Calder turned towards the door. The chief astropath gestured.
"Before you go, we have heard from the astropath assigned to the mining facilities, my lord. It seems your warriors have begun preparations for the enemy's arrival. Lieutenant Karros wished to pass along his intentions to thin their numbers."
She shook her head.
"I think he will have his work cut out for him myself."
Calder paused at the door.
"We all will, my lady. We all will."
Almes, Primus Asteroid Facilities. The landing bay was a utilitarian space, given over to the most basic of necessities. One of a dozen on this side of the facility. Once, ships would have been entering and exiting the bay in a near constant stream. Now, ore cutters sat in their berths, awaiting launch. Karros studied the vessels. They were of a size with a gunship, but less graceful, and little more than reinforced hull bays, engine compartments and control pods. Each of these pods was inhabited by a servitor pilot, hardwired into the vessel's systems. Each also had a small array of equipment, designed to shatter debris or cut through wreckage.
"The engines here have rerouted backup power in each, to the las burners, as you requested,"
Reyes said, slapping the hull of the closest. Karros glanced at her. She looked exhausted but determined. That was good. He needed them determined.
"We normally use them to cut through debris, but they'll do some damage if they get close."
Karros nodded. Las burners were little more than scaled-down versions of ship-mounted lancers. If enough of them were aimed in the right direction, it'd be a good impression of a lance battery.
"How many?"
"A few hundred. The fuel cells burn out if we keep them running too hot for too long. The power you'd need to tear through an undamaged hull, might get one good shot or two, depending.
She ran a hand through her hair.
Think it'll be enough?
No, but it doesn't have to be. What we start, the orbital defences might be able to finish. And if not them, then the Capulus.
Even then, by itself, the strike cruiser would have little hope. But Karras saw no reason to say so.
And if not?
Karras looked over the ore cutters, estimating the likelihood that any of it would work. From what he'd seen of the enemy fleet, precious few of their vessels were ships of the line. Most were repurposed merchantmen or barges, carrying troops and supplies for the ground forces. Those would be their targets.
Then we will have done our duty and well.
She nodded and fell silent. Then, hesitantly,
why did you kill Galba?
The question didn't surprise him. In fact, he'd been expecting it long before now. Perhaps she'd needed the time to gather her courage.
Galba was the face of oppression, was he not? You think about what you hate about this place, and it's Galba's face you see, or saw. I made a strategic calculation designed to win you over.
He looked down at her.
Did it work?
She laughed sourly.
Yeah, they loved that bit where his neck popped.
She frowned.
You'd have killed every one of us, if we hadn't backed down right then.
It wasn't a question, but he thought it deserved an answer regardless.
Yes. My orders were to deny the facilities and their resources to the enemy. If I couldn't do it one way, I would have done it the other.
She shuddered lightly, a sick look on her face.
I told them, you know. I said you'd do it. That's why some of them have gone to ground, I think. The others are just stubborn. They think whoever wins will be open to dealing with us on more even terms.
Karras nodded.
Never underestimate the value a human being places on their life.